Bush.
Also broadcast live on UPRN 105.5 New Orleans. I'm your host, DeAndrew, and tonight my guest is Robert Salas. But before I introduce my guest, I would like to say that I know my fellow Americans and even people the world over are aware of the significance of today's date. 9 years ago today, a violent and cowardly attack was perpetrated on American soil, an attack brought about by hate and intolerance. I pray that someday our world will learn to live without such hate. I would like to ask my guest and the listening audience to please join me in observing a moment of silence in remembrance of those we lost on that day. I thank you for that, for participating in that with me. Robert Salas is a graduate of U.S. Air Force Academy and holds a master's degree in aerospace engineering. In March 1967, he was working night shift as missile launch officer in charge at Malmstrom Air Force Base in Montana, with the responsibility for a battery of nuclear-armed Minuteman missiles. Deep underground in the capsule, he received repeated alarm reports from ground-based personnel at ground level of a large, red-glowing, disc-shaped craft hovering over the base. A disturbing series of events then began to unfold. The UFO hovered over each silo, and one at a time, the triple redundant system controlling each missile was systematically shut down until the entire battery was offline. The UFO then departed, and it took technical crews most of the following day to get the missiles back online. Mr. Salas has been a guest on my show before, and it is my great honor and pleasure to welcome him back as my guest this evening. And thank you again, Robert. I appreciate you joining us this evening.
Thank you, Dee. It's a real pleasure to be with you, and also I want to thank you for that moment of silence. Of course, it's heartfelt from all of us. I know I can remember where I was when that happened, and it was just so horrific, and we all remember that horrible day. But it's great to be on, and I'm real happy to be with you.
And I appreciate you being on this evening. And also, you have a press conference coming up here pretty soon.
Oh, yes. There are going to be 7 ex-Air Force witnesses. All of us were stationed at nuclear weapons bases. And going back, I think, to 1962, there have been many, many of these incidents of UFOs over nuclear bases. Robert Hastings, who's co-sponsoring the conference with me, has written a book called UFOs and Nukes, and he's documented, I think, over 100 such cases. But we've got 7 good men who are going to stand up and telling the truth.
Well, how many speakers have you got lined up for the press conference?
Well, seven witnesses and then Robert Hastings, so they're going to be eight of us. And, that'll be it.
Oh, wow. That's a lot of speakers. One of the things I was really curious about on this press conference, and do you have any idea how many cable network news are going to be covering this, or will you only find out about that?
We're in the process right now of contacting TV and print media, and of course we're going to contact members of Congress and invite them to be present at this press conference, or their representatives. As you know, this subject sometimes gets put on the back pages and gets ridiculed, but we're going to do our best to try to get as many mainstream media as we can out there. Right now, we're not sure who is going to be there.
Oh, and our next question, and this is also shared by New York Lily in our virtual auditorium, was whether or not there would be some place where online people can go to watch it and listen live, and also if this is open to the public as well, and what time does it start? That was another part of her question.
Yeah, we're going to start at noon on the 27th at the National Press Club. At this point in time, because of the expense, and that's one of the reasons we're still appealing for donations. Anybody that wants to donate to this effort, because it is a grassroots effort, we're not sponsored by any organization. We're not part of MUFON or any other group. We're just Robert Hastings and I decided we needed to do this, and we got seven good witnesses to come help us. So we're still asking for donations for the expense of putting this conference on. If anybody wants to donate, they can go to www.ufohastings.com, and it'll lead you to the donations. But right now, we don't plan to do a live webcast unless we get additional funds. What we will do, however, is we're gonna videotape this fully. And that tape will be available soon after the conference. As far as other people attending, we would entertain a special request to attend, but really the conference is for the media. We want the mainstream media there to listen and write stories and spread the word about these very true events.
Yeah, and I was wondering, and other people in our virtual auditorium, is if when we do find out which media outlets show up, if there is a way that we could email these outlets and ask them to either, if it's newspaper, to print it, or if it's broadcast, to cover this on their news programs.
Well, sure. I think any of your listeners could do that. Go on the CNN website, for example, and put in a comment that you'd like to see them cover it. We'll be contacting all the media, all the major TV networks. But like I said, we haven't got any guarantees at this point as to who will be attending.
Oh, here's another good question that just popped up in our virtual auditorium from Skymon. And he was asking if the press release will be available in a digital format so that our listeners can forward that to the different media.
Well, I believe so. We're going to get raw video, and we're going to turn it into a DVD, so we'll be able to at least get it out to the public via DVD. We'll probably put it on YouTube or some of those sites so that all the public can have access to it. Again, this is a non-profit type effort. We're not trying to make money off this at all. Any funds, I should say that any funds that we collect will either be used for the expenses or will be given to charity. We're not going to keep any excess funds on this. Yeah, that includes selling of the video.
Okay, and also, if I remember correctly, that if anybody has frequent flyer miles, they can donate those as well.
Well, at this point, everybody's got a ticket.
Oh, fantastic.
We're going to make sure everybody gets there, and we've got the location set up. We paid for that, so we've got the basics down. It's just these little extras like a live webcast type thing that we can't afford at this point.
Oh, gosh, you hear that, people? You know, every little bit helps. If we can get enough money set to these guys that they can do a live broadcast where we can all see it as it happens,
right?
The better, the absolute better. You have 7 speakers coming to join you. Can you give us a hint of maybe one or two of the situations that these individuals will be speaking about?
Sure. Let me run down real quick. I'll just give you a brief overview of the speakers. We've got Dwayne Arneson, who is a retired lieutenant colonel, and he was at Ballastrom Air Force Base, same time I was. He was head of the cryptographic section, and he saw a message that was going to be delivered to Strategic Air Command headquarters while he was on duty, confirming that UFOs were hovered over the site when the missile site shut down. So there again, that's confirmation. And we've got Bruce Fenstermacher. He was a Minuteman III missile launch officer in Francis E. Warren Air Force Base, 1976. And again, he had UFOs hover over his launch site. We have Colonel Charles Hult, who is at the RAF Bentwaters base in England in 1980. And I think most of your listeners have heard of him.
Yes.
What most people don't know is that there were nuclear weapons storage sites at Bentwaters, and that this object, the objects they saw did send beams of light over those storage areas. Of course, Robert Hastings has been investigating this for some 30, 35 years, I think. I mentioned his book, UFOs and Nukes. Robert Jameson, he was, at Maelstrom the same time I was, only he was a targeting officer, and he was ordered to restart all of the missiles that shut down that were under my command. That was Oscar Flight. I think most of your guests might know that there are two flights of missiles that went down. One was Echo Flight and one was Oscar Flight, although they went down about a week apart, not on the same night. We'll have Patrick McDonough. He was an Air Force geodetic survey at Maelstrom in 1966, and that's when they were just trying to set up one of the newly constructed missile sites, when they had UFOs come right overhead. Jerry Nelson, he was the first lieutenant in Walker Air Force Base 1964 under the Atlas program, Atlas missile. And his guards report UFOs hovering over his launch capsule on a half dozen occasions. And then, of course, myself. So That'll be the lineup.
Oh, impressive. Very impressive. And what's the date of that again?
That's going to be March 27th at 12 o'clock, 12 noon. Did I say March?
Yes, I thought it was going to be this month.
Oh, dear.
Sorry.
Yeah, September 27th, that's this month.
Okay, fantastic. I was thinking, gosh, what'd they have to do, move it back? Oh, my. In your own case is, in my opinion, very fascinating. Gosh, 10 missiles going down, one right after the other, within seconds of each other. I just find absolutely amazing. And I can only imagine what was going through your mind while all of this was happening, being stuck so far underground and only know what's going on, you know, above you from the gate guards.
Yeah, it was a pretty tense situation because, as you know, I got two calls. The first call from the topside guards that they were just observing lights, strange lights flying in the sky, and then making odd maneuvers and going very fast and stopping on a dime, that sort of thing. And then the second call, by the way, I just kind of ignored that first call, but the second call, he was quite frightened. You could tell by his voice he was very agitated, very scared, and he had all the guards out there with their weapons drawn and aimed at this object. It was an elliptical shaped glowing red object, and he didn't know what to do. I can't blame him. This was a very frightening experience for them, and then when he reported to me, I was frightened myself because I thought we might be under an attack of some sort. It was tense. Then the missiles go down right away, and while this thing's still up there, and we were all flabbergasted over this, pretty much in shock.
I can understand the idea or the thoughts of possibly being attacked, because this is at the height of the Cold War.
Yes, right. Yeah, we were still, of course, in Vietnam, and it hadn't been that long since we had the Cuban Missile Crisis, and of course, we had the Cold War going on with the Soviet Union and China, and so it was a tense situation. That's another reason I'm convinced that this was not an Air Force exercise, because the Air Force would not have disabled 20 missiles intentionally to see what we would do in that situation. And of course, I confirmed this with my squadron commander later that this was not an Air Force exercise. I was there for 2 years. After this incident, nobody ever debriefed me on what happened or why. So it was definitely not an Air Force exercise. This was a real incident.
I was to refresh my memory on your book, Faded Giant, which, by the way, I thoroughly enjoyed reading it. There's some documents in the back of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I apologize because I should have marked it in. I thought I did, but I guess I didn't. But in the first document, which is several pages long, the only thing they were able to really determine was that some outside source caused these missiles to shut down, but they were never able to pinpoint it.
Right, right. Yeah, they, after appearing on the Art Bell Show, and this was in 1996, I was contacted by Bob Kaminsky. Bob Kaminsky worked for Boeing aircraft at the time of the shutdown. Boeing was was one of the prime contractors, subcontractors for the missile system, and they had overall kind of overview authority over the technical aspects of the weapon system. This is the Minuteman 1 system. And so they were called in to do an investigation, and Kaminsky was in charge of that investigative team for Boeing. And I've got written correspondence from him stating that they looked at all aspects, all the technical aspects of the system and its operations, and concluded that they could find no valid reason, or no reason that they could come up with for this to happen. This was a very reliable system. The missiles themselves were independent of each other. So they could come up with no reason, and they were going to report that, but they were told at the last minute not to file a final report to the Air Force because it was considered a UFO incident. This was a quote from Kaminsky. It was considered a UFO incident, and the Air Force did not want a final report written. And we can go into more detail, but the reason the Air Force didn't want a final report on this was because at the time the Conant Committee was investigating the UFO phenomenon, and the Air Force didn't want to open that can of worms. They didn't want the Conant Committee to get wind of the shutdown. So there was a lot of hush-hush around the investigation of the Echo and Oscar incident.
Gosh, I'm trying to find it. I'm kicking myself in the pants for not marking some of these. I actually found it.
Okay.
There was in this first report, document, on page 38 of the document, there's one little short paragraph that talks about I'll just read it here and let everybody decide for themselves. This is rumors of unidentified flying objects around the area of Echo Flight during the time of fault were disproven.
Yeah.
A mobile strike team, which had checked all November flight launch facilities on the morning of 16 March 67, were questioned and stated that no unusual activity or sightings were observed. You know, that statement there says a lot. You know, they were trying to hide it.
Well, of course, you know, anybody reading that would ask, the first question they'd ask themselves is, how do you disprove a rumor? You know, I guess one way is to find out who's spreading that rumor and make him fess up that he was spreading a rumor. But, in fact, I of course reported the UFO incident in my case in the Echo Flight. The crew reported UFOs overhead, and those that other crew, the Echo Flight crew, which is Walt Siegel and Eric Carlson. And by the way, they're still alive and well. The last time I checked, and they both have backed up what's in my book as far as the details. And they do, at least Walt Siegel did affirm that they were interviewed. In Walt's case, he was interviewed by SAC headquarters. So that information that you quoted is from the historical document, the Unit History, which was a quarterly document that went out every quarter. But it is false. It's blatantly false because there were UFO reports by my guards, by his guards, by maintenance people, by the crews. All of us reported UFOs. This was no joke. We were not. We were never trying to perpetrate a fraud or a hoax. these were official reports. And so that is one instance where, again, it's an official document where the Air Force is lying. Let's just tell it like it is. They were not telling the truth.
Well, that kind of, in my opinion, goes hand in hand with all these documents mysteriously and unauthorized destruction of from Roswell, at the time of the Roswell incident.
Right, exactly. In Roswell's case, the Roswell incident, there are many reports of witnesses being intimidated. And I'm sure that happened in our case, too. In my case, we were told not to talk to anybody about this, ever. So we were under orders not to talk to anyone, including anyone in the Air Force or family of anybody.
Another question that popped up in our virtual auditorium that I think has some validity to it. This again is from Skymon, and he would like to know how it is that you were able to talk about it if you signed a security oath.
Right.
And did you sign a security oath saying you didn't speak about it?
Yes, I did. I signed a security oath. And I didn't talk about it until about 1994. In the summer of 94, I was in a bookstore. This time I was out of the Air Force for some time. I resigned from my commission in 1971. So I was in a bookstore and started reading through a book called Above Top Secret. Just happened to pick it up. Just happened to turn to page 301, and there on page 301 of that book by Timothy Good was a paragraph stating that the Echo flight shut down in March of 67 while UFOs were overhead. So I got kind of excited because it sounded a lot like my incident, and I even for a time thought that's where I was when my missile shut down at Echo. I later found out, of course, I was in a different flight. But I took this information and went to the local MUFON chapter because I wanted to find out if the Air Force had declassified the incident because I knew it had been classified. And so they went ahead and I contacted James Klotz, who was the co-author of Fated Giant. He's an outstanding investigator, very thorough. But he had been working with the Freedom of Information Act for a while. So I asked him to write to the Air Force about the Echo incident, but not to mention anything about UFOs. Just to ask them if they had any information on the strange shutdown of 10 missiles in 1967 in Malmstrom. Well, so he did. He wrote to the Air Force under the Freedom of Information Act, and they wrote back and said, basically, this is still a classified incident, but since it's been so long, and since you've requested it under the Freedom of Information Act, we're going to go ahead and declassify it, and we're going to send you some documents. So they did. They started sending us documents. One of the first documents was a telex, stating that the missiles went down under unusual circumstances, and everybody was just dumbfounded as to why. But at any rate, at that point, I felt, and again, I was under the impression that I had been wanted Echo flight, and since the Air Force declassified it, I felt I could go ahead and talk about it. And so I did. I started going on radio programs and did a sightings. I don't know if you remember the show Sightings. I did a special TV program on it. And so I started. Then I got other people to come forward, people that had come been there, and started contacting other witnesses. And it kind of went from there. So that's how I. And it wasn't until later that I found out it was an Oscar flight. But by then, I was already very public about this. So I decided to keep going.
It kind of strikes a chord with Milton Torres, where he was sworn to secrecy about being ordered to fire on an object that he was sent out to intercept.
Uh-huh.
And he was sworn to secrecy as well, and never talked about it until it was declassified. About a year or so ago. I have a lot of respect for our, as ex-Navy myself, I have a lot of respect for all the military people who come forward and tell their stories. And I think they're very significant because these are ones that never made the headlines.
Yes, yeah. And it does take a bit of, I don't want to, I hate to use the word courage, but it does take some thought to come forward because you know you might be the subject of ridicule and this is still a subject a lot of people have trouble believing. So,
and unfortunately that does happen.
Yeah.
We refer to it as the giggle factor.
Yes.
Right. And that's what this show is all about, is trying to get rid of the giggle factor, to show that there is something to this.
And that's right. We need to get over that giggle factor. So, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that this is a real phenomenon. And the public needs to start thinking in that direction, that this is a real phenomenon, and their government knows it's a real phenomenon, and their government is keeping this big secret from the public. And we have a right to know.
I agree. A statement was made in our virtual auditorium that I agree with 100%. I said they won't arrest these military witnesses because they are going to say, you're talking about UFOs. Well, U.S. Air Force says UFOs don't exist, so what the heck? I agree with that. One other thing that I thought was kind of interesting when going through these documents in the back of your book, they were putting it together a way to try and test whether it was an EMP, electromagnetic pulse,
mm-hmm.
that shut down the missiles. Were they ever able to get that test going? And if so, what was the result?
We contacted, there were a couple of individuals in the telex that I mentioned, the telegram, asking for a study. When this was the day after the Echo flight shut down, and the Strategic Air Command headquarters asked for a study and named a couple of individuals from Boeing, and we tried to contact both of those individuals that were in that telegram, and one of them had. One of them went ahead and did a bench test, what he called a bench test, I think it was the guidance and control system. Some of the parts of the guidance and control system, and in that bench test, he did shoot it with some electromagnetic pulse and was able to activate it or disarm it or something, affect it in some way. So, yeah, there was this thought that there was some sort of electromagnetic signal or pulse that might have been the cause. But, again, we're talking about a signal or a pulse that would have had to have penetrated about 60 feet of earth and concrete down to where the cables were, and then penetrated the cables, which were triply shielded, and then inject that signal back to the missile, which was about a mile away, a mile or two away from the launch control facility. I wanted to correct you a little bit when you on your opening statement. The UFO hovered right over the launch control facility and not over my missiles. But in the Echo flight, in that case, the UFOs were seen directly over the launch facility. That's where the missiles are.
Oh, okay.
At any rate, and then my missiles were shut down as a result of that. So that's why they were not able to identify the source of this EMP.
That's what I was when I was reading that. I was thinking, "Holy cow! What?" I was wondering why they would think that an EMP could do that when all this stuff is underground and shielded. You know, I just couldn't understand the reasoning behind that. And then they were talking about some work that was being done at a civilian power company's substation. They were replacing some equipment, and they were even trying to see if that had something to do with it. But then they found that was done, it didn't specify how much time difference, but it was done before the incident happened.
Right.
You know. So it seems to me like they were grasping at straws.
Yeah, they were. They were trying to look for some rational explanation for this. As a matter of fact, we've got another witness that has told me that as of 1972, the Air Force was still trying to determine why the Echo flight and Oscar flights went down. In a technical manner. In other words, trying to come up with a technical reason as to why the case went down. So,
5 years later?
Yeah, that many years later.
Wow.
They were still trying to determine that.
That's amazing. Holy cow. I didn't realize that they were trying to find the cause for that long.
Yeah.
That's mind-boggling. You'd think that if they were going to find a cause for it, that it would have been within, you know, a few months to a year, but 5? Wow.
And, of course, there were cases, many cases after mine, long after 1967. We know of witnesses that have come forward from the 1975 time period, 1979, again in, in the 90s, into the 90s, and again, we have UFOs flying over missile sites and affecting the weapon systems in one way or another. Mr. Hastings has told me about another witness he has who said that a UFO flew over the entire missile field at one of the bases and caused actually launch lights to go on. We have a panel showing the status of the missile and one of the lights is a launch light. So there's a lot of witness testimony out there. You know, these seven people that will be talking in September are just a very few, the tip of the iceberg of very many witnesses that could come forward if there was, for example, a government hearing, a congressional hearing on this. I think we would fill the place up with witnesses.
Do you know if there were any similar instances in the former Soviet Union?
Oh, yes. I have a note on one that occurred in 1982. just go by memory here, but in 1982, UFO overflew a Soviet ICBM and actually started on its launch sequence. So, and it just scared the heck out of the commander. And this commander is a, I guess, equivalent of a lieutenant colonel in the Russian Air Force, has given an interview. I think it was to David Ensor of ABC News. Actually, it was a TV special on it. But yeah, that was a pretty frightening experience there. I started the thing on its launch sequence and basically stopped the launch sequence at the last minute.
Oh my. That could have been the start of World War III right there.
Yes, and that's the other major issue here, and that is, in my opinion, of course, this thing happened, these things happened, UFOs are focusing on nuclear weapons sites because they want to send us a message, and that message is to get rid of our nuclear weapons, because obviously they could just destroy the planet and every living thing on it. So that is just speculation on my part, of course, but that's my opinion, that these incidents are really a message more than anything else, because I think if they wanted to, they could do a lot more damage to us than they have done. So I think they were just demonstrating that they have the ability to shut down our weapons.
Or launch them.
Or launch them, yeah.
it kind of baffles me, you know, that the Air Force, if you try to contact the Air Force about a sighting or get some information from them, you get the standard, you know, we no longer investigate UFOs and yada yada yada. The Air Force has determined that UFOs pose no threat to our national security. Well, your incident and all these other incidences that you know, these seven men that you're bringing together here in a few days, just shows us all that statement's a crock.
Yes, that's a good way to put it.
I'm trying to be polite about it.
It just amazes me how long they think they can keep saying that. Well, they've gotten to the point, of course, the Air Force doesn't say anything about UFOs now. They don't even acknowledge anything about it. We're just going to keep pushing our stories and until they become overwhelming, and they're just going to be more and more of these stories people come forward on this. I don't know how they're going to be able to eventually keep from making some kind of a statement about it.
I keep thinking, what is it going to take for them to finally come clean, other than a light standing on the White House lawn or something like that? It just surprises me. I have a question here from our virtual auditorium. This is from Gossamer, and he asks, during your time in the military, did you ever speak to any Air Force pilots that had encounters or sightings?
No, not personally. No, I didn't speak to any that had encounters or sightings. I was mostly, when I was, my duties in the Air Force were in the Minuteman system, and also worked on the Titan III program in propulsion, as a propulsion engineer on Titan III. So I was more of a ground pounder engineer type.
We have another question from our auditorium. This one's come from Cartoonist. And he would like to know if you have had any kind of flashbacks from the incident.
Flashbacks? Well, you mean as though it were a PTSD type thing?
I suppose, yes.
No, I'm trying real hard to remember a lot of the details. Some of the details have still escaped me, like the names of my guards, who I try to make an effort to remember at the time. But, you know, a lot of water under the bridge in 40 years or so. But I can't say that I had any flashbacks as far as fears or something like that. Nothing like what a combat vet would have.
Have you been in contact or talked with recently any of the guys that were, you know, your top side guards?
I have not been able to contact any of those top side guards. Now I have contacted other guards. Other guards have come forward. One in particular at Malmstrom Air Force Base who saw an object. But he was not one of the guards at Oscar or Echo Flight at the time. A lot of these guys, of course, this was in 67, so a lot of them were weapons trained, and they were probably a lot of them were sent to Vietnam. And I'm guessing, but probably a lot of the witnesses to these events were dispersed off the base. I know at least one or two of my, I think two of my guards in particular, were taken off, taken away from their duties and given other duties or sent to other bases immediately after this happened because I never saw them again. And because they were particularly frightened by the whole thing. A part of our incident involved security violations at two of the launch facilities where the missiles were located. So not only did the missiles shut down, but we had indications that the security was violated in the fenced area around the missile itself. And so we sent guards out there to investigate. During that investigation, they saw UFOs over the site. So, and they were pretty shook up about that when they got back. And as a result, again, I think neither one of them ever came back on security duty.
Wow. How many of them were there?
How many guards?
Yes.
We had different crews up there. Some, I think we had at least two guards. Well, we had three guards. We had the main flight security controller, and then two guards that were on their alert status. In other words, they were wide awake, ready to go. And then we had a backup team up there. So, you know, there was like five or six guards up there.
Again, referring back to some of these documents, the historical quarterly reports, they keep mentioning a strike team. What exactly was a strike team, and what did they do?
Yeah, a strike team is usually two guards. They're the security people up there, and what they would do is their duties included driving to the different launch facilities at various times during their tour, just to check things out, make sure everything was okay, and of course they would have to respond. That's why they're called strike teams. They have to respond if we got security violations, which were not infrequent. We would many times get a security light come on. You know, we had a panel down there which showed us the status of the security systems, and every, at times, you know, a jackrabbit would jump the fence, or
I find it amazing that back in 67 that there would be detection equipment, so to speak, that would detect something as small as a rabbit hopping across the ground.
Yes, absolutely. It was very sensitive.
Oh God, I could. I'm sorry for chuckling because it seems rather humorous that there'd be all these armed guards running out to go chase a rabbit. It just struck a funny chord with me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we had to be careful. These were nuclear weapons.
Okay. My producer is asking if I could get you to speak up just a little. We're having my listeners are having a little bit of difficulty hearing you.
Okay. Sure.
Oh, much better. Oh gosh. Let's see. Made me lose my train of thought here. So the strike team were basically, for an analogy, like the security police at Bentwaters, they were the ones that would go out and investigate everything.
That's right. They would investigate anything we thought was anomalous out there. You know, like I said, we had indicators in the capsule that showed any violations of security at any of the sites.
And just out of my own strange curiosity, how long of a time stretch did the launch crews spend down in their little underground capsule cubby hole?
It was generally 24 hours. And then we'd get relieved every 24 hours, depending on weather, of course. At times we got snowed in, we had to stay there for a lot longer, because we're talking about Montana. In the wintertime, it gets pretty bad.
Oh, yeah.
And then we'd get relieved. We'd probably go have 3 days off, something like that, and go back on alert.
So it was like a three-team rotation?
It was a rotation, yeah. I think we had three or four launch crews that would simply rotate over and over at each of the launch control centers, we call them.
Oh, so gosh, I can imagine how well-stocked that would have to be. With food, water, cooking facilities.
Yeah. They had cooking facilities upstairs. You know, we didn't have all that stuff downstairs. We had the business part of the weapon system downstairs, and computers, and which had air conditioned constantly at that time. You know, that we didn't have miniaturized computers then. We didn't have circuit boards. We had those old radio tubes. I don't know if you remember those old radio.
Oh yeah, I keep thinking UNIVAC.
Yeah, right.
the old UNIVAC computers that took up an entire huge room.
Yes.
Gosh, I keep thinking, you know, my laptop here probably has more computing power than what was on the Apollo mission.
That's right. That's right.
Gosh. Okay, and on that note, it is time for us to go to a break, and we'll be back in 8 to 9 minutes with more Eye to the Sky, the UFO synopsis here on UFO Paranormal Radio Network. Welcome back to Eye to the Sky, UFO Synopsis here on UFO Paranormal Radio Network, also broadcast live on Uperion 105.5 New Orleans. I'm your host, DeAndrew, and tonight we've been talking with Robert Ballas. Robert, all the stuff that you went through with your incident in March of 67 and all the others that happened as well in other places, it kind of makes you wonder if the occupants of these UFOs, which I personally subscribe to the extraterrestrial hypothesis, that's just me, it makes you wonder if they were just toying with us or demonstrating that they had the capabilities to do this or just having fun, and I'm kind of curious if how you felt.
I too subscribe to the ET hypothesis, and primarily because these objects did things that I know we didn't have the technology to do at the time, or still. I don't know that we've got anything that could replicate what they did to my missiles. So I don't think they were toying with us. I don't think, I don't know what kind of sense of humor they might have. I think it was purposeful. I think they knew what they were doing, and they wanted to send us a message in the best dramatic and graphic way they knew how, so that we would understand it, and that is that they know exactly how these weapons work, and they know how to shut them down. They know how to they know how to shoot them off, launch them. This is something really fantastic. I know it's just hard to believe, but all I can do is tell you that it really happened, and a lot of other witnesses will tell you that it really happened.
Gosh, I mean, I can't imagine what it would be like being cooped up underground like that and knowing that you've got guys topside that are seeing these objects and reporting to them to you, knowing full well that, like you said yourself, that after the first call, you kind of, oh yeah, the guy's just joking with me. Mm-hmm. But what was going through your mind when you finally realized, hey, these guys aren't kidding?
Like I said, this was a real shock. We were kind of flabbergasted by the whole thing. The entire time after the missiles went down, we went through our procedures. We reported the command post. The command post reported back to my commander that the same thing had happened at another flight. I always remembered that. Fred Maywald was my commander down there, and he turned to me and said, the same thing happened at another flight. At the time, I thought, well, he meant the same thing happened that evening at another flight, but what he was told was that it happened before, and in fact, what they were talking about was the Echo incident, which happened about a week earlier. And we were relieved. The first thing I did was go upstairs and talk to my main guard up there, the topside guard, and look him straight in the eye and say, are you telling me the truth about what you reported? He said, yes, sir. These guys were very professional. Like I said, everybody knew we had nuclear weapons, and we had to be highly professional in operations with these weapons. So this was no joke. There's no way they could have perpetrated a hoax up there because they have no control over the missiles topside. We had all the controls underground where we were, and they certainly couldn't have timed a joke at the same time our missiles went down. So. We were all shocked. Went back to the base and reported to our squadron commander, and he was shocked. And this was an old World War II veteran. He flew B-17s in World War II. He had a lot of combat experience, and he was white as a sheet. He could not explain to us what happened.
So let me get this straight. You were Oscar flight?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And about a week before your incident was Echo flight?
That's correct. In the book, Fated Giant, at the time I wrote that book, I was under the impression, again, because of my memory of my commander turning to me and saying, the same thing happened another flight. Those were the words I remembered. I was under the impression that Echo and Oscar went down the same day. But after the book was published, another witness came forward, and we have determined now that Oscar flight went on down on March 24th. And the reason we're able to do that is because this witness, he's going to be one of the men talking on September 27th, Robert Jameson. He was ordered out to restart Oscar flight, and when all 10 of their missiles went down during a UFO event. And this is what he'll testify to. And on that day that he went out to restart Oscar flight was the same day that a UFO was observed by a truck driver driving to Great Falls. And this incident we call the Belt sighting, because Belt is a small town near Great Falls, and that's where he saw this this object. And it was not only seen by him, but it was seen by a Montana Highway Patrolman. And this incident was written up in a long file, and it was a blue book file. And we've got that file also in our book. I don't know if you thumb back in the appendix, you'll see you'll actually see his handwriting. Anyway, the Belt incident was March 24th, and that's the same day that Robert Jameson recalls going out to Oscar flight. So we're able to nail it down now that Oscar went down on the 24th, Echo went down on the 16th of March.
Oh, wow. I wasn't aware of that aspect. Well, like I said, I'm going by your book. Again, reverting back to the document in the back of your book concerning the incident at Minot.
Yes.
I find it interesting that the incident at Minot happened in 1966, the year before.
Right.
And there is, you have in here the complete blue book report of the Minot, the report sent to Blue Book, I needed to correct myself, from the Minot incident, naming people, and full details. And on that one, not only was there ground observers of these objects, they've even got the report from a radar operator.
Yes, right. The Minot incident, the reason I put that in is because I wanted to show a kind of a sequence of events. But Minot happened, I think the report I've got in there is August of 1966. And like
yes.
You said, is that the one? Yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And in that case, the UFO overflew Mike Flight. Mike was another launch control facility, and disrupted communications. So, which is common with these close encounters with UFOs, they disrupt electronics. And it was actually tracked on radar, I think from 500 feet all the way up to 100,000 feet. That's in a letter signed by an officer. I forget his name now, but that, yes, that's a part of the Blue Book record.
Major Chester Shaw.
Yes.
I correct me if I'm wrong, but in 1966, I believe the only thing that we had flying that could go anywhere near 100,000 feet would have been the U-2 Dragon Lady.
Right. Yeah, 1966. I'm not sure when the U-2 was developed, but I know. See, I was an aircraft controller also in 1965, and we had radar that had the ability, we had height-finding radar that had the ability to go up to almost 100,000 feet. As I recall, it was more like 70,000 feet, but in 65, so I don't know, that, you know, they may have made progress in that short time period. But I know we didn't have any operational aircraft that flew at 100,000 feet. Any aircraft that we had that would go that high would have been experimental or secret spy planes like the U-2.
I'd have to look it up, but I'm not quite sure of what the flight ceiling is for the U-2. Interesting thought.
Yeah.
But gosh, I mean, going from 500 feet. You know, 100,000, that's 500 feet, that's the map of the Earth flying.
Yeah, that's right.
Gosh, and we didn't have, well, unless it was like a small private plane.
Right, and I think in that report also there's a diagram of the track that the object took, I don't know if they made an estimation of the speed, but it probably made some very strange maneuvers. Yeah.
I wouldn't doubt. They're notorious for that. I mean, you hear so many reports of incredible 90-degree turns and going to a dead stop and then taking off at incredible speeds.
Right.
Amazing. You know, it just baffles me and makes me wonder, you know, how they can do these turns without some kind of a radius. Amazing. Did you get to speak with any of the guys that were involved with the Minot incident?
No, I have not spoken with any of them. We haven't tried to contact them. Of course, if any of them want to come forward and discuss their incident, I'd love to hear from them. We have so many witnesses, really, that we had to kind of decide who to talk to as far as witnesses for our press conference, but. No, we didn't contact them.
Gosh, I'd love to hear what would have been a little fly on the wall at your incident or any of these others. Just, you know, if nothing else, then just to study it, how people react in that kind of a situation.
Right.
It would be interesting to. How would you go about even testing whether somebody would be able to keep their cool under something like that? I know you yourself probably went through some form of psychological testing for it. After all, you and your partner were the men with their fingers on the proverbial button.
Yeah, I think we did. I think they did do some kind of psychological test on us. Of course, it was a sensitive job. When I think back on it, I don't know how I would have reacted if I'd been ordered to launched 10 nuclear missiles. Of course, it would have that would have been during a World War III nuclear war, which none of us want to think about. But like I said, it's still a possibility. I mean, there's still a danger of having a nuclear war, and that's why one of our purposes is to try to bring this issue to bear so that people will understand that we do have to have complete disarmament of nuclear weapons worldwide. We have to find a way working together to do that.
Gosh, and here in 67, I was, let's see, this happened in March, so I would have been 8 years old at the time of the incident, living in Southern California, and the highlight of my evening in the summers was if Vandenberg was launching test missiles, and you could see them in the sky, and it never dawned on me that, hey, that, you know, could possibly be an armed weapon that could kill untold thousands of people.
Yes, that's right.
You know, it just boggles your mind.
At last count, we had there was about 20,000 nuclear weapons or nuclear bombs worldwide. Most of those, of course, we have between us and the Soviet Union still. We've got some, you know, close to 10,000 weapons or bombs operational at this point in time. That's just us. And each one of those are probably, I would say, 100 times more potent than the bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki during World War II. So you can go from there, and in each of those cases, they lost about 100,000 people in those attacks.
And the missiles that you were in control of them, what was the nominal yield of just one?
Let's see. I'd say at a minimum 300 kilotons was the yield. The Nagasaki Hiroshima bomb was something like 15 kilotons, and the Nagasaki bomb was about 20 kilotons. Of TNT. The smallest of the bombs that we have right now is about 300 kilotons. But they've also detonated hydrogen bombs, as you know, which go into the megatonnage. We're talking about up to 50 megatons, I think, was the largest bomb that the Soviet Union had. I think the largest bomb ever exploded, hydrogen bomb, was about 20 megatons. That's 20 million tons of TNT.
Now, the point I'm getting at is, in this line of questioning, is that you had 10 of these things online. Just you and your partner had 10 of these things. No, wait a minute. 10 of them went down. Is that the complete complement that you were in control of?
Yes, that's correct. Uh-huh.
Okay. That 10 of these massively destructive weapons were turned off just like that. I mean, just quick.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
In less than a minute, I'm guessing.
That's right, less than a minute.
And there wasn't a thing you could do about it.
That's right.
And they still say no threat to national security.
That's right. That's a big lie.
Oh gosh, in some of my husband David and I, in our research we've been doing, you know, we've come to the conclusion, now David's telling me that I'm going a little bit low, let me put my mic a little closer. In some of the research that we've been doing, we've determined that the Project Blue Book, which this comes to no surprise to anybody, was just a public relations ploy to downplay it, you know, just to explain it away, to prevent hysteria among the populace.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And all the really important reports or sightings or incidents, such as yours and all these others that that affected our capability of defending ourselves, went to the Navy. Do you think that is a plausible scenario?
Well, of course, I have no way of knowing where those reports, but I can tell you from the research I did of one particular case, and that's the case of Lieutenant Colonel Lewis Chase, and I think this happened in 1957. He was an RB-47 pilot, and he and his crew took off from,
I think I know the incident you're talking about, and I can't remember where they started.
Yeah,
either.
Anyway, they flew around for a couple hours. They were on a training mission, and they came across a UFO during this training mission. The UFO followed them for quite some time, I think about 2 hours, till they finally landed in Kansas. But during this time, the UFO was tracked on radar. It was tracked on their radar that they had in the aircraft. Of course, there was a log, and when they landed, they were met by AFOSI. AFOSI confiscated their log and told everybody this was a classified incident and not to talk about it. So in 1967, Lieutenant Colonel Lewis Chase, he was Lieutenant Colonel then, was at Malmstrom Air Force Base during my incident. And he was what the Air Force designated as a UFO officer. In other words, he would be the kind of contact for the Condon Committee to help them, you know, in their investigation of UFO incidents. And so when he met with the Air Force General, I think that was in charge of that Condon Committee, or not in charge, but the one that coordinated with him, he asked about his own case, and if the Condon Committee could review that. That was a Blue Book file. It should have been a Blue Book file, because Blue Book was the place where all these reports were supposedly went. Well, somebody in his organization contacted Blue Book and asked about the details of this case. And Blue Book reported back, said they didn't have it. They didn't have this very important case, which is well documented at the time. And so it was later determined that this was a classified case. In other words, Blue Book had, like you say, the minor cases, but there was an area where classified cases or very sensitive cases were kept. So anybody that thinks that all the UFO reports were in the Blue Book files is mistaken. There are many other reports that were highly classified that were not part of those files. And we were able to verify that.
Well, and then the RB-47 case, I do remember that it did fly over the states of Louisiana and Texas and then into Kansas. It wasn't only just a training flight, but they were also testing, if I'm remembering correctly, some new radar gear, onboard radar gear. And also they were detecting some kind of a signal coming from the UFO that was following them.
Yes, that's correct.
Now, that was a very, very significant case.
Yes, it was. And Dr. James McDonald interviewed Colonel Chase, I think it was in 1969, and I've got a tape recording of that. But anyway, that tape that McDonald made of his conversation with Colonel Chase about that incident is at the University of Arizona. They've got a depository there of James McDonald's records.
Yeah. Oh, one of these days, I'm going to get down to Tucson. I live in the Phoenix area, and I would give my eye teeth to get down to Tucson and go look through McDonald's records. He is a hero of mine. I think the man did a wonderful job.
Yes, I agree.
And most of the time on his own dime.
Yes. And he kind of gave up his career to do this.
Oh, and then he did a lot of research under contract to the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
Which,
yeah.
You know, again, me being ex-Navy, I'm like, good choice, Dr. McDonald. Let's see, we've got about a little less than 20 minutes. I'd kind of like to go in again on the upcoming press conference. I want to get as much information out to the listeners on the conference, on date, time, location, and possible media outlets that might be there.
Yes, it's going to be September 27th at 12 noon at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. It's and basically it's for the media, credentialed media. We're going to ask only the credentialed media attend, and also any member of Congress or their staff that wants to attend. We're going to specifically invite members of Congress because we'd like our government to know about the facts of these cases and hopefully try to look into the possibility of opening up government files on UFO cases and opening up this issue again because it's an important issue involving. Not only the UFO phenomenon, but excessive government secrecy in covering up these cases, which means that we've got some kind of a secret government going on, and then also the issue of nuclear weapons, something we all need to be concerned about again. Obviously, we've got a crisis involving Iran, who's trying to develop nuclear weapons. We've got North Korea trying to develop nuclear weapons. Pakistan seems to be an unstable government with nuclear weapons. So, to me, this is something that's just kind of being ignored, but it could turn into a serious international crisis that would affect all of us. So we're going to be speaking, you know, the seven of us witnesses are going to be speaking specifically about UFO sightings over nuclear bases, and we're all, like I said, have signed affidavits about our incidents. In other words, we're putting our word on the line under our signatures. These have all been notarized and sealed, and we'll have press kits for media and would like to help out, please feel free to do so. And if you'd like to donate any money to our effort, you can go to UFOHastings.com on the internet, and it'll give you instructions on donating. Of course, any amount is welcome.
One question I don't think anybody's thought to ask, and it just dawned on me that I hadn't. You were saying earlier that any money's left over would be donated to charity.
Yeah.
Do you guys have a specific charity picked out?
We don't. At this point, we don't have a specific charity. I guess that's something we'll have to talk about afterwards.
Personally, for me, if it was me, it would be for autism.
Autism, yes. That would be a very worthwhile one.
Oh, yes. It was just posted here in the virtual auditorium. Another suggestion, too, is for disabled vets.
Yes. Yes. That would be very worthwhile. And we will, we'll have to consider all these things. Hopefully we will have an excess that we can contribute, but we'll make that known to the public. We will make a point of that.
I would appreciate that, because I think both the donating the leftover funds to a charity and getting this press conference out, put together so that these men can have an opportunity to speak out on their experiences is very noble. I think you and Mr. Hastings are doing a wonderful service getting the word out that these things are real. They're here. There's no denying it. And they do mess with the military.
Yes, thank you, Dee. We're a committed bunch. That's all I can tell you. Robert Hastings and I have thought about this for some time, and we finally decided to go ahead and do it no matter what. And so both of us have had to, reach into our own pockets, but it's well worth it.
I agree. I agree. And anybody who wants to donate can do so through UFOHastings.com?
Yes.
Okay. And let's see. And please do so, people, because if they can get enough money acquired to do this, they would possibly be able to stream this live via the internet so that we could all get a uninterrupted and unedited by the media view of what's happening, which
yes.
I myself would love to see that.
Yes, I would too. That would be ideal if we could have it streamed live.
Oh gosh, and you have Just out of curiosity, you said you have seven men speaking. What kind of a range of time? Like, say, we know that the Minot incident happened in 66, and when was the last one that you've heard of?
You mean as far as the speakers go?
Yes.
I think we're range the time. Would range from 1964 to, I'm going to say, 1969, maybe. So it's in that time period.
A five-year stretch. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, obviously, men, were any of them at the same incident, covering the same incident, or these seven different incidences?
Well, like I mentioned, three of the witnesses, myself, Robert Jameson, and Arnie Arneson, will be talking about the Echo Oscar incidents. So they were at Malmstrom at the same time I was.
Oh, okay. On both Oscar and Echo flights.
Right. Yeah, let me make a correction. One of our witnesses, Bruce Fenstermacher, his incident happened in 1976.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And where was he stationed?
Francis E. Warren Air Force Base in Wyoming.
Wow, this seems like they kind of like the Northwest.
Well, that's where our weapons are located. That's where the missiles are.
Oh, that's right, to shoot over the cap, to pull it out.
For the most part, yeah.
I lived in Idaho for more years than I care to admit to, not far from Boise.
Uh-huh.
And there was a missile base off. You know, between Boise and Mountain Home Air Force Base. It makes me wonder if there was any incidences that happened there.
Near Mountain Home?
Pretty close. Like I said, somewhere between Boise, the city of Boise, and Mountain Home Air Force Base.
Gee, I am not aware of any in that area. But that's not to say there haven't been. I just haven't heard.
Gosh, you know, I've never been out there. I don't know what type of missiles they had, other than ICBM. I don't know whether they're like, you know. In fact, I'm kind of not very well versed on the different types of ICBMs, but I do know that there was one out there that had been closed down. And I don't even know when it was closed down or when it was in operation. It just dawned on me, hey, I wonder if anything happened out there. It'd be interesting to do some digging and find out. Hmm.
Well, maybe some of your listeners can call in and find out for you. Yeah.
That would be interesting. If anybody's out there, you know, if you were stationed out at that particular missile facility, which I don't even know the name of it. For all I know, it could have been associated with Mountain Home Air Force Base or Gowan Field, for that matter. I know Gowan Field and Mountain Home work together quite a bit. If you guys know of anything that happened out there, hey, you know, go to my website. There's a email me button there and let me know. I would be very interested in finding out. And so would you, I suspect, Robert.
Absolutely. I'm very interested in this whole subject. And I've been following it for 15 years and probably another 15 more anyway.
Okay. I've just been informed that next week there will be no live shows, so I'll have to reschedule my guest for next week. Let's see. I'm kind of at a loss of where to go from here. We've pretty much covered a lot of the information on the incident that you were involved in, and a lot of the press conference. Is there anything that you would like to bring up that you feel we haven't covered or haven't covered enough?
Well, we could talk a little bit about the connection with the Condon Committee. See, the Condon Committee was set up in 1966, as you know. The University of Colorado was given a $500,000 contract by the Air Force to study the UFO question, and this was a result of sightings in Michigan, I think, that a lot of people saw and got excited about, so they put pressure on Congress. Congress put pressure on the Air Force, so the Air Force decided they were going to have some kind of a study done by an outside group. Well, there was a connection with my incident. One of the main investigators for that Connor committee was a Dr. Roy Craig, and Craig got wind of the Echo flight shutdown from Ray Fowler. You probably know of Ray Fowler.
Oh yes.
And Ray was working for Sylvania at the time. He was working. Sylvania was a subcontractor on the Minuteman system, and so Ray got the information from some of his fellow workers that were located at Maelstrom, and so he relayed that information to Dr. Roy Craig of the Conan Committee, and Craig actually met with Fowler, and I've got this documented again. If anybody wants to read about this, they can go to the UFO Chronicles website. It's the UFO Chronicles. Anyway, I've written a paper on this. It's called Back to Montana, I think. But I've got all these details in there. At any rate, I'll tell the story here. Dr. Craig visits Ray Fowler, and Fowler gives him the information about these missiles shut down during a UFO event, and so Craig decides to visit Montana, Maelstrom, and he does so in October of 1967, October 67, and the first person, and by the way, Craig had names of individuals to talk to interview. And the first person he meets at Maelstrom is our Lieutenant Colonel Chase. That's the same one we just talked about, who was the base UFO officer. Well, Colonel Chase, to put it politely, doesn't tell the truth to Craig and tells him that there's no UFO involvement in these shutdowns, and that he should wait for a final report on the Echo shutdown, and he'll but it'll be classified, of course. And the only person on the Conan committee, by the way, that could review classified material was Robert Lowe, who was the deputy to Edward Condon. So Roy Craig turns around and goes home. He doesn't interview anybody, and this comes from Craig's own notes that we were able to get a hold of recently. Craig had written notes about his visit to Maelstrom, and also he wrote a book, by the way. Dr. Craig wrote a book about his involvement with the Conan Committee. But at any rate, Craig just turns around and goes home and doesn't interview any of the witnesses, doesn't interview me or the Echo flight crew, or any of the guards. None of these people does he interview. He just turns around, goes home, and takes Chase's word for it. Now, why did Chase lie? And we got Chase lying again when Wright Patterson writes to him, and Wright Patterson had an office that was obviously a blue book was there, but they also had an office that was studying this question and asked Colonel Chase if the UFOs were involved in the Echo shutdown, and Chase again in writing says no. Well, you can come to your own conclusions as to why he didn't tell the truth, but my take is that that this was going to be they were going to put a lid on this as best they could. They were going to keep it quiet as best they could, and so at any rate, that is how the Air Force kept this information from the Conan Committee. So when the Conan Committee finally wrote their report, it had nothing on the Echo or Oscar incidents.
Oh, that doesn't surprise me in the slightest. It really doesn't. Edward Condon knew before they even got started what conclusions he was going to come to.
Yes.
Exactly. Well, unfortunately, Robert, we are all out of time. Gosh, I could have gone on for another hour.
Well, thank you, Dee. I appreciate it.
Oh, I appreciate it myself. You know, this has been a wonderful discussion, and I just wanted to let you know that we hit 100,238 live listeners tonight. And thank you, Robert, for helping us pull those numbers tonight. And thank you, listeners, for joining us.
Yes, thank you again.
And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for tonight. I want to thank everyone for tuning in and also thank all those who joined us in the Pal Talk Auditorium. Stay tuned for Voice of the People, hosted by November Hansen. Her guest this evening is Bernard Hage. And please join us again next Saturday for Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis. And we're going to try and do a pre-record for next week. It's what I've been informed of here in the last few minutes. And if so, if we can get with Mr. Hastings, Mr. Robert Hastings, to be able to do that, he will be our next guest. So until then, keep an eye to the sky. Good night, everyone.
In a fighter combi, on a hippie trailhead full of zombies, I met a strange lady. She made me nervous. She took me in and gave me breakfast. And she said, do you come from a land down under, a women go?